Hello and welcome to episode 38 of Gamers Footnotes with two S's. I am your co-host JT along with my fellow co-host Steven.
Hello everyone.
And our email address is still gamersfootnotes@gmail.com with two S's, so feel free to send us your hate mail or your comments or why you think we're great or what you want us to talk about or your grandmother's pancake recipe. We're interested in anything and everything. And on this week's episode, we're going to continue our discussion on gamers culture, and we're going to focus on the rise of broadband as being a ubiquitous thing, and which sort of coincides with the rise of the mega publishers. And for our short segments, Steven's going to talk about the latest MMO launch and WildStar and what has been similar and what has been different. And I'm going to talk a little bit about the silent protagonist and pontificate on why characters like Mario, Gordon Freedman, and Master Chief are some of the most popular characters in gaming and actually have very little characterization. So it should be fun times all the way around. So last time we sort of ended up with the golden age of consoles, where you saw at the height of it anywhere from 3 to 4 consoles coexisting at the same time, all with sort of a diverse smattering of games, which all basically sort of got shattered by the eventual rise of the Xbox and PlayStation 2 as dominating the field. And you see companies like Sega passing into the quiet night as it sort of gets kicked out. And we see a lot of Nintendo's missteps on trying to go from a cartridge-based system to a disc-based system and getting weird things like the Nintendo 64 and then the GameCube, which are sort of bizarre in light of the CD standardization that the PlayStation 2, the Xbox, and the PC have all gone to, that Nintendo kind of attempting to maintain the console fort, so to speak. And really what you start to see in this time period is in the early 2000s, going all the way to about 2003, you sort of see a solidification of the internet. And on the PC market, you see really the first two sort of stable versions of Windows, where 95 and 98 were basically constantly being patched, features were constantly being added, PC components were pretty bleeding edge, DirectX was in a very rough state, getting founded out. And on the PC front, you really see 2000 and then XP sort of solidify gaming as a platform that will work. I think XP has been the most popular version of Windows by far. And so you sort of see what we kind of talked about earlier in the PC market, where you had a fragmentation of the market based on what graphics cards you had. You really have two winners, ATI and NVIDIA, sort of rise out of these ashes. And I think sort of we want to talk a little bit first about the PC Master Race, because we feel like we haven't given them enough love, and as card-carrying members, we, you know, feel obligated to talk about them some. And sort of in the height of the PC market from this era is, I can remember, the Unreal Quake 3 war. And that sort of became a dividing line, not just among the software, but on the hardware. Quake and John Carmack and id had always been big proponents of OpenGL, which sort of was what ATI was backing. And so you see the Radeon cards looking really good at running Quake 3, conversed with Unreal and sort of that engine following more the DirectX model, which had always been sort of an NVIDIA mainstay, where NVIDIA always saw themselves as part of the Wintel cartel, so to speak. And for people who don't know, Wintel was a briefly lived slang term for Intel-based Windows PCs, because there were other processors before Intel. And down in this time period, you sort of see AMD coming onto the scene and cementing themselves as the second big processor. And looking at this, you kind of see a national gravitation of NVIDIA, Intel, DirectX forming one PC gaming block, and you see AMD, ATI, which eventually merge into one company for logical reasons, and OpenGL forming a third PC block. So you really do have two competing PC platforms, which is kind of an interesting phenomenon that I think a lot of people forget about now. And on the console side, you really just have what we call the big three, which is now really just two and an also run, which is Sony and Microsoft, and Nintendo being an also run with the 64 and the GameCube, which is not really a serious threat to the PlayStation 2 or the Xbox.
No, the console gaming at this point, the N64 used a cartridge-based system, still used battery backups, which meant you, we now had the concept that you could move saves. The N64 played with that a little bit, and that you could get cartridges for your controller that could allow you to move saves from controller to controller, I believe.
Something
the N64 did. Weird. It was a very strange system that was ultimately a little bit clunky. Also, cartridges are generally just more expensive to produce than discs. It's really as simple as that. And then even when they moved to the GameCube, they insisted on using a different kind of disc than everyone else. And if there's anything Microsoft, Nintendo, and the rest of the world should have learned by now, it's don't get into a format war with Sony. They are not just a gaming division.
They're a media conglomerate.
Yes, and they build a lot of the devices that play media. And Microsoft was not prepared to actually enter the market of selling HD players to HD devices to the general public outside of the gaming community. And that's what ended up, that's why we have Blu-ray now, is that there was no one who was going to be able to push that to the general market. And Nintendo, but before that, the one people forget is Nintendo, in some sense, tried to do the same thing, not in as profoundly silly a way, since they were just dealing with gamers and gaming devices. But the problem they had was that PlayStation 2, since it had been using CDs, disc-based formats for a while now, was able to be completely backwards compatible with PlayStation 1 games. The GameCube, the N64, and the GameCube kept changing cartridge types, or then the changed cartridge to mini-disc. And as a result, because in many ways, because the internet was not where it needed to be yet, they were not backwards compatible at all. And so you actually had to have multiple devices. All of these kind of little things really, on some sense, contributed to an overall picture of Nintendo not competing nearly as well at this exact time period.
And One of the really interesting things is the history of the Xbox and sort of the rise of the Xbox is one of the few times where we can sort of go back in our culture hats, so to speak, or anthropologist hats, and look at what actually creates a culture around the console. Because the original Xbox came out of nowhere. I mean, Microsoft basically one day showed up and said, we're making a console. And we're calling it Xbox, and people are like, what does Xbox stand for? And they're like, Direct Xbox, which was its code name. So the interesting thing is, in a corporate sense, and a lot of things we've talked about in these episodes, is how much corporate economic realities then turn around and influence gamer culture, even though gaming culture tends to deny that existence. And the Xbox got really born out of the idea that the PC gaming market was too unstable, that the technology changed too quickly to actually enjoy games, that you had to refresh your hardware for every big release. And it was expensive, and it was difficult, and there was all these conflicts. So Microsoft, for one reason or another, set out to sort of make PC gaming into a console. And that's what the Xbox is. It was sort of this notion that you would play traditional PC games on your console, so you weren't really a console gamer, PC gamer. You were a PC gamer with a fixed computer that would always play the greatest games. And that's why the biggest success for Microsoft was Halo. And that's why Halo proved to be such a phenomenon that it was, is that the whole system was catered towards PC gamers who at this point were really locked into the first-person shooter as being the dominant genre of the platform. You had Unreal and Quake competing on it. You had sort of other entries into the first person, but that's what the gamers wanted. And then the next big first-person shooter was Halo, and it appeared on the Xbox. And initially Xbox only, eventually appearing again on the PC. One of the interesting things about Halo is it was actually originally a Mac game that seems to get lost in the mists of time, where Mac basically excluded out gaming at this point because it wasn't interested in games anymore. It was interest. It decided to go towards the artist market, and the Mac gamer more or less dies during this period, and hasn't ever been seen again. I mean, it's sort of the extinct gamer.
So what this does kind of to our series on culture is that with Nintendo declining in an absolute sense, we've discussed previously how gamers were getting older, and with Nintendo going into decline, it accentuates the effect of kind of a more mature game because
right.
Nintendo is not providing any kind of counterbalance at this point. They maintain, they hang on, certainly. They don't do disastrously poorly exactly, purely off of the weight of their first-party titles. Zelda games both do very well on the N64. There are big releases on those consoles, but in an era where gaming is expanding much more into the public consciousness and gaming consoles are getting even more and more penetration into the general American market, Nintendo is not the driving force behind what people are thinking of when they think of video games.
No, and I mean, you almost see Nintendo's marketing and Nintendo's culture, the Nintendo gaming gamer at this point goes from being exclusively Nintendo, which is what the culture was at the Super Nintendo, where, you know, I own a Super Nintendo and that's what I own. That's what I play. Or I own a Genesis and that's what I play. Is you sort of see a subtle shift in the core Nintendo audience being like, well, I enjoy my Nintendo as a supplemental console. It supplements my PC. It supplements my PlayStation. It supplements my Xbox. And you sort of see this notion that Nintendo gamers are much more inclined to accept a large lull in releases, that they don't need a new Nintendo game every 3 months. They just need a couple a year to justify their console purpose because it's sort of a... in a sense, it's almost like the fast food of gaming. It's quick, it's dirty, it's easy, you like it, it's a guilty pleasure, but it doesn't supplement, you know, a large 12-course meal that you want. And you sort of see that becoming the dominant Nintendo culture, where now I think you don't even really see Nintendo fanboys, much like there used to be at this time period.
The division is definitely between the PS4 and the Xbox One, and even before that it was between the PS2 and the Xbox. Nintendo still had some clout, but it really did lose quite a bit with the GameCube especially, I think, is where the decline became the most
It
pronounced.
Became a huge misstep, because the GameCube, the derogatory term gamers came up with it was the Game Purse, which we can get into a whole different set on why that's offensive on so many levels. But the notion was that it was an accessory, that it wasn't... That the more underlying purpose is not that it's Nintendo no longer released standalone consoles. They released accessories that you'd have as a supplement to something else. Just sort of like the Game Boy's always been considered a supplement to a real console.
But with the Xbox coming in, Sony finally, for basically the first time, had competition on the third-party market.
Right.
And that also caused third-party developers to frequently to get better deals to kind of lock into exclusivity contracts. Which in turn gets to kind of another one of the major points we're going to discuss, which is the conglomeration of a lot of these gaming companies into much larger units who could avoid these exclusivity contracts. It's not a coincidence that we see a lot of the consolidation of EA during this period.
Sure, buying the smaller studios.
Yes. A big part of it was hard to compete when you were being essentially forced into an exclusivity deal.
Well, and another interesting thing on this point is that, you know, it gets talked about in a game like Game Dev Tycoon, which is a really interesting look on the evolution of the problem faced game developers, is that the PC had a low barrier of entry. You just have to basically get the discs printed. So you could be a much smaller publisher on the PC. You could be somebody like Interplay and exist solely on PC sales and very little on the console. But when Xbox and Microsoft through the Xbox was driving PC game development towards the console, that it became harder for smaller studios to compete on their own. And that's why you started seeing another consolidation, that if you're a small company with a small footprint, you can't really afford to make a console game. But if you join a bigger conglomerate, then you can start to make console games, which is EA buys other PC game manufacturers. I mean, they don't go out and buy console game manufacturers. They know what they need to go get, and that's IPs. And PC companies were the easiest to go basically pick off.
And so that, and what that ends up doing, well, ultimately it'll lead to cultural issues we see today, where Electronic Arts can be voted the worst company in America multiple times in a row, because gamers sort of rebel against this, not entirely unreasonably, but one aspect of this that is perhaps glossed over is the issue of nostalgia. That
sure.
People believe, well, the game was better when it was Westwood Studios before it became EA, when in reality, even Westwood probably would not have been able to make 10 Command & Conquer games and have them continue to be reasonably good games. It's probably not actually EA's fault. It's probably a function of time. But because of the sequence of events and the way these things happen, EA ends up getting blamed for it. And that creates, in turn, we start to see the beginnings of what will eventually blossom into the indie market in this period. Very small developers who continue to try to stay outside of what is the generally accepted mainstream of gaming. This is also when it becomes vitally important to realize that gaming is no longer a counterculture in any rational sense of that
term. It's now become mainstream.
It probably wasn't for years before this, but once we really get into the later part of the PS2 era, the penetration of consoles into the American public is such that it is unusual to see a household in middle America without a console, at least one console.
And the interesting thing is it's really the DVD that drives that.
Right.
Because mom and dad will buy a console that is a DVD player because they can use it as a DVD player. Right.
And so to call gaming a counterculture at this point is, frankly, simply erroneous. However, once gaming becomes a culture, anytime something goes from being a counterculture to a culture, inevitably a subculture develops that is an internally held counterculture. And that will eventually create a lot of different effects that we'll get to later, but one of the big ones is sort of the development of the concept of the indie game developer, the small game publisher. Now that this is big business, we can differentiate between the big players and the little players, and there begins to be sort of a following that develops for smaller players.
Well, and another thing that's worth sort of discussing, especially in the move to being a mainstream culture, is when Doom is released, parents are crying out that Doom's going to lead to the end of Western civilization and all our kids are going to worship Satan and, you know, kill babies and horrible things will happen. When Mortal Kombat's released, parents are decrying that this is the worst thing ever to happen and, you know, this is going to be the end of Western culture and, oh God, help us. When Grand Theft Auto 3 is released on the PlayStation 2, you sort of see these same arguments again, but now the courts and society as a whole and the backing of bigger business is basically like, we don't care.
Yeah.
It's just a game. You see them get First Amendment protection.
It's done as a media hype issue and some quick ratings boost, but there's really no serious action taken except by people who are really fairly publicly decried as not particularly good at their jobs.
And it's interesting because whenever you see now people talking about games that are corrupting youth, they almost always go back to the counterculture gaming games. You see Doom and Mortal Kombat frequently are the two highlights on any news station when they talk about the evils of video games. You almost see no discussion about games from the modern era, and that's because it's big business. And big business will protect itself.
And so, and that in turn trickles down to culture, because this is, I think, where we, it's always been there, but where you really start to see the division amongst gamers between someone who plays video games and a gamer. Because now that this is a cultural issue within American, well, and other countries as well, but within American culture, it's not enough to simply be a gamer because everyone's a gamer, and so it starts the subcultures to begin to develop to further define what is now the dominant cultural trope, and that's where you get Xbox gamers and PlayStation gamers and hardcore gamers and casual gamers. And while those terms are not in as frequent use at this point, you do start to see them coming up more and more frequently, particularly among the PC gaming crowd.
And this is sort of the rise of the fanboy culture. Everybody was a fanboy of something. No matter if you're a Halo fanboy, you're an Xbox fanboy, you're a PlayStation 2 fanboy, you're a JRPG fanboy, the big gaming lexicon was the term fanboy. And, I mean, that word has a huge negative connotation to it. And that was intentional. Because you really see this cultural war occurring across the internet, across, you know, living rooms, across friends, across whoever. Because there was no... it was not about the games. It was about what you were representing and what that said about you.
And a lot of people, the gamer crowd frequently had both consoles anyway.
Right, which became hilarious.
And it became a major point of, oh, well, you should listen to my argument because I own both consoles, and
right,
therefore I know which one is better. It's like, not, that doesn't actually logically follow. That just means you own both consoles and you've tried both, but everyone's tried both.
And you have a preference.
Yes. But all of this does also spark the beginning of video games being taken seriously. This is when you're going to start seeing Ebert making some of his more impassioned arguments that video games are not art, and the corresponding arguments from the other side explaining exactly why video games must be art. And this is really the era where I'm sure those words had been uttered in some form before then, but this is when people actually start paying attention to the concept that video games can be art, and we start seeing more games that are self-aware of the fact that they are art coming out of this era. Oh, the original Okami...
Yeah, it's a PlayStation 2 game.
Yes. We start to see, especially, well, I shouldn't say that. I'm more familiar with the PlayStation 2 in many ways, so I really shouldn't say the PlayStation 2 had more of this than the Xbox.
Well,
but,
I mean, we can sort of break it down in the sense on not necessarily art games per se, but sort of this notion of the best entry into the Star Wars universe is not a Star Wars movie or a Star Wars novel. It's Knights of the Old Republic for the Xbox. That's the best Star Wars story that's told. It's being told on a video game. You have sort of this best notion of cyberpunk. The best entry into cyberpunk during this era is Deus Ex, which is a video game. You have this sort of notion of deep, complex stories are being told in JRPGs. Here's stories about... here are the new fairy tales, so to speak, are now JRPG games.
Final Fantasy X is a fairly major influence within,
sure,
RPGs for years to come.
And it's a giant fairy tale. When you,
yes,
when you break it all down, these are not fairy tales that are being told in more traditional media we see. We now see them being told in video games. You see the sort of absurd modernism not being in Jackson Pollock paintings or in paintings or Andy Warhol. You see it in Fallout. So you sort of see you see gaming, I don't want to say evolve because I always think these things were undercurrent there, but you see them becoming more refined, more defined, more ability to point towards, hey, this is what this is about. I mean, is Grand Theft Auto any different than any Quentin Tarantino movie?
Well, and we really start to see, because of pure advances in technology, there are more tools to tell stories,
sure,
which in turn influence culture in a number of ways. Because you can tell a more detailed story about loss and a hopeless situation, Final Fantasy X, you can reach more people, and it makes more sense. It resonates more deeply. Not to say the previous Final Fantasy entries, 7 is still, I think, generally considered to be the most popular for various reasons. But the more people you can... culture is not necessarily about being the best. It's about reaching the most people in a way that's meaningful to them.
Right.
And as we have more tools to sort of approach people who might be put off by polygonal graphics or put off by a lack of voice acting becomes a much bigger deal here because we finally have the ability to actually put voices in games. That ends up being a major step forward because now we really have entered the realm of interactive movies. The best example I will ever be able to come up with, of course, being Xenosaga, and the famous or infamous, depending on one's preference, 45-minute cutscenes.
Sure.
These are effectively movies with gameplay put into them.
Well, and they're complicated. I mean, Xenosaga is written as a three-part gaming series that was originally envisioned as a 12-part book series. I mean, these are artistic endeavors that are now being attempted at video games.
Right.
I don't think... if you listen to what the people say about Xenosaga, they attempted this to be artistic. I mean, they were making a cultural statement.
Exactly. And so this, I really think, is that not, there was artistry, as we have spent no small amount of time explaining at every point before this. But this is kind of where we get the concept of the art game. The right. game that is very self-conscious of the fact that it is art. And the stories become much more aware of the fact that they are telling a story. It isn't an excuse so that there's some reason for us to have humans go kill orcs. It is a purpose unto itself, and oftentimes the gameplay becomes subservient to the story, whereas before the story was always subservient to the gameplay. And that reversal is important because now we see the more traditionally accepted elements of art, narrative, composition, those start to take a bigger and bigger role. And as that happens, the consumers, the culture surrounding games, becomes more concerned with art. And so even though we may not have formalized critics or within the gaming community at this point, in the sense that you have art critics or literary critics, effectively, gamers themselves are becoming the critics, just as the general public is ultimately the only critic that matters. That's sort of what's happening with gaming, because this is no longer about a quick 15-minute entertainment or something to do when you're bored.
Playing until you run out of your five lives.
Right. This is now about accomplishing a goal, learning about the story, seeing what kinds of graphic challenges this game has taken on. Those, you know, when people, may often think it's silly when people talk about, oh, well, this game had more polygons, or this game had, a better aesthetic. It may seem like a lot of, people would decry that as fanboyism. It's like, oh, well, you only cared about that because that's a game you like. But really, on some level, that was art criticism.
Right.
That was, well,
it's criticism about the composition.
Right. About how the elements fit together. And so while it was often kind of mocked by the community at large, not entirely unreasonably, a lot of it was simply because, kind of a form of tribalism, it was still the beginnings of a critical scene within art. You had sort of a group of people who had taken it on themselves to look at games critically on a compositional basis, rather on purely a basis as a gross entertainment.
Well, and you sort of hit the nail on the head, because in other art medias, we still have elements of tribalism going into it. The one I classically always think of is Impressionists. There's a fundamental difference between French Impressionists and English Impressionists. Even though we can broadly lump them together, they saw themselves as being fundamentally different. And that's that discussion of what made their Impressionism different. I just went to the art museum and saw an exhibit on Sargent, and one of the things they talked about that made his painting so different is his physical paint was better.
And what school was he part of?
Isn't he an Impressionist?
Well, yes, but French.
French.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But many people may not know who this is.
Okay, sorry. but the point is that one of their big examples in this art exhibit was they spent a lot of it talking about where he got his paints, that he bought American paints because they had a richer color content than traditional European paints. But that's no different than arguing about my graphics processor can push more polygons than your graphics processor
can. This game is capable of using this. And what was interesting here is that the technology was much more obvious.
Right.
Using the painting example, technology has always been a part of art.
Exactly.
Even if it was as simple as access to a more robust language set when you're dealing with plays written in ancient times versus with more modern, sophisticated linguistic sets. Even that is actually a technology argument, even though it may not seem like it. But with video games, the technology was always the first argument. What kind of technology can this use? And that actually is, I think, an example of the culture driving the narrative. Particularly in the West, and I think we may have mentioned this, but Japan is generally included in the West when discussing video
Which is
games.
Why it's weird when video games are like, the Japanese gamer is different than the Western gamer. We're really not.
Japanese gamers are a different subset of Western gamer, but especially for purposes of this particular conversation, they were effectively a Western nation. They would not appreciate that, and I apologize to our Japanese listeners. But what we mean by that is it was sort of the areas encompassed by the PlayStation, Xbox, and PC as the major kind of gaming systems, where they were frequently present, where there was a large percent of the population that had access to these devices. Within the West, technology and science had begun to be regarded much more highly as recently as World War II. But again, with the advent of the computer revolution, technology has been sort of the driving force behind a lot of cultural conventions. You start to see modern art doing a lot more with multimedia displays, for example. Video of a forest played on three screens shows up in the major metropolitan museums of art, and that's because the concept of what we can do with technology, what is permitted now with this technology, and the thing is it was a very conscious decision in other art forms. It was ubiquitous and natural for video games. Because it was always about what can we do with the technology.
Right.
And that in and of itself sort of informs how the art develops around video games, because they're really taking the premise that's being used in modern art in other forms, and it's already built in to what you do with video games. The first question you have to ask is, what can I do? And so that sort of informs how video games develop in an artistic sense, is that we're always the critic, the viewer, the person, the consumer of the art, is also very keenly aware of, what can my game do? What can this game do? What can this console do that this console can't? And it's a cart and horse issue, or excuse me, a chicken and egg issue. It's hard to tell whether the culture was driving the development, or the development was driving the culture. But ultimately, all of it is very concerned with technology and what is the technology allowing us to do at this point. And that's a huge thing going into the transition to the PS3 and the Xbox 360, is they are marketed as they aren't marketed as much, for the first time ever, I think, off of what our starting lineup of games is. The big thing in the initial marketing push for both those consoles is, I have a cell processor.
Right.
I'm a Blu-ray player. I'm an HD player. I have a more ergonomic controller. And that's the startup lineup is, of course, vitally important. Don't misunderstand me. But we're really still talking about the technology and what we can do. Sony makes a huge deal out of the fact that you can actually do quantum calculations with the cell processor and help unravel the mysteries of proteins. Folding at home was actually a fairly large deal at launch. People talked about folding at home and the SETI project, that's name I've just forgotten, but that you could...
Yeah, I forget. I think they just called it SETI.
SETI. I think it's just called SETI. But basically the search for extraterrestrial life.
Right.
These were technology-based concerns, and even how the starting lineup was marketed, well, on the PlayStation 3... It became a question of, well, you'll get better frame rates.
Right.
We have a higher, deeper blacks and, more shades of gray. These became major marketing points. And it had always been about the technology, but generally it had been so different. What a PC could do versus what a console could do. What a Super Nintendo could do versus what a PlayStation could do. And now it's not really different. So we get into much more subtle nuances of the technology. And anytime you're dealing with nuance, you're almost implicitly dealing with art, because you're dealing with the subtle distinctions in the shade of color shaders. You're dealing with what is resolution, if not how rich the colors can be, and why you would buy American paint is the same reason you would buy something that could work in high definition. These are all actually the same analogs to technology driving the production of art that we've seen for thousands of years.
Yeah, and I mean... one of the big things is Steam, and that's sort of, you see the unification on the PC platform is the rise of Steam, and I think we're still on the rise of Steam, as they haven't shown any signs of slowing down.
Well, I think we're pretty firmly in this. They may continue to go, but we're pretty firmly in the Steam era.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. But I don't, like, in the terms of the Roman Empire, I don't think we've seen the plateau.
They don't appear to be in the period of decline.
And one of the interesting things that we always, in this sort of gaming as art discussion, is Portal. Portal's one of the first games that most gamers will point to when they say, look, this is art. Portal. But one of the things you never really see discussed is that one of the reasons why that's true has nothing to do with the game, but it has to do with everybody owned it because they owned Half-Life 2. Everybody downloaded it because it was part of the Orange Box and downloaded onto Steam. Everybody just played it because, I already own this, why shouldn't I just go ahead and play it?
And it's not even really about Portal being a great game. It is a great game.
Right.
But it's less about Portal being a great game and more about the cultural understanding that games can be art, and that art is really...
And people experience it.
Right. And that art is about the experience. That
right.
Art is about the composition. And because I submit that Ebert was not entirely wrong. Much of Portal's elements would not perhaps be considered art in the abstract sense. The trick is the composition is certainly art. And the composition is the interaction between the narrative and the mechanics and the graphical style and everything else working together can only appropriately be viewed as art, even if perhaps the code itself, though I think there's an artistry to code, but that's neither here nor there, the code itself might not be art. And you could maybe argue that the narrative and the graphics are independently art, but the reason the game is art is because they are... The narrative combined with the puzzles, combined with the graphics, is not merely a combination of those elements, but is something more than all of those elements. And we become more and more aware that that's true, that you could not actually simply tell the story of Portal and then play a game about jumping through portals and have it be as rich an experience as doing both at the same time.
Which is why you don't see Portal clones.
Right.
Because inherently, it's a lot like how art can be where it's... You've sort of seen the... I don't know where I was going with that thought. But you sort of see this notion that Portal existed as a conflux of circumstances that have not occurred since. And people sort of understand that it's not... Video gaming has always been about cloning other people's technology. There's been a lot of rifting off other things. Mega Man's a rift of Super Mario Brothers. First-person shooters often steal from each other. RTS games steal from each other. You know, you've always had this legacy of borrowing and building on.
Innovation versus convention.
Yeah. And Portal sort of struck at this one chord where all the factors work to make Portal work. But there's nothing in the Portal mechanics that we haven't seen before. And the elements that get borrowed from Portal are much more interesting in my mind, are much more about the interaction of the game to the player. And the one scene that I always port to that I would say where Portal becomes art is the where you're sitting with the companion cube at the Inferno Pit, and GLaDOS says you have to put your companion cube in the pit before you can advance. And you can sit there forever, and the door's never going to open. And then once you put the companion cube in there, GLaDOS' response to you is always, you did that faster than anybody else ever did. And I'm paraphrasing because I don't remember the exact line. But at that point, you see in gaming the same things you see in movies, the same things you see in books, the same things you see at art, is you can see the designers of the game having one sort of set of why that occurs. And then you have each interpreter of it having a different opinion. Is GLaDOS being honest when she tells you that you did that faster than anybody else? Is she being dishonest? Will she always say that no matter what? And now you start getting into speculations of motives. And this is just like novels. This is just like anybody who wants to take an F. Scott Fitzgerald novel and start breaking down the motives of the characters. You now really see this in video games in a way that's relatable to everybody. Everybody's going to have a visceral reaction to that. Even if the reaction is, I don't care. But that says something about you. That says something about the experience.
That's the mirror that art represents.
Right. And I think at that point, everybody saw that the mirror can exist in games. That there is an emotional hook that will reflect you into the game that game developers hadn't really fully internalized.
And as the experiences get richer, the culture necessarily responds by becoming more nuanced. You know, subdivision is not necessarily a bad thing. You start to see a lot more of people who, well, I like games with a story.
I like
games that are graphically intense. I like games for this and that. And that conversation is in many ways the proof of the development of culture, which is in turn proof of the development of art, if we view culture as sort of the natural reflection on art or the natural reflection on society, which is in turn reflected in its art. This is we have better tools, we have more societal acceptance, we have greater penetration into society. All of these factors mean that the culture generally is becoming more rich, and that you start to see game reviews be less about, will this work on X machine?
Right.
Is this
a technologically sound game? Right.
And even less about, is this fun? And more about, why is this fun? What right. kind of person will find this fun? And so game reviewers start to take on the role to lesser or greater extents of critics.
Well, and one of the interesting things that I kind of want to note it here is PC Gamer, which has been a magazine around forever. One of their editors during this period is Gary Whitta, who then went on to go do the Walking Dead series of games, which everybody thinks is art, and is now becoming a writer for one of the Star Wars movies. So you're seeing what we're kind of talking about here is you see a cultural acceptance of people getting their start in gaming. That these people in sort of what we consider traditional are getting born out of here and are now crossing over into more mainstream things. And you sort of see, I mean, Star Wars is the quintessential movie franchise. And now a person writing that is coming from reviewing video games, which is sort of a cultural shift that nobody's really blinking at that. That's not huge news.
So that's, and really we see that continuing. Really this trend has done nothing but intensify moving on through the modern era, which I think we're going to talk a little bit more about next time. But kind of where we get to is we have the advent of Steam and the resurgence of computer gaming is something that is much more mainstream than niche. Through the modern era, the one big shift we're going to see isn't so much in the culture, but so much in the culture becoming strong enough that it tends to be a unifying force, pushing PC games a little bit closer to the console. A lot of PC games are played with a Xbox controller at this point. And we start to see the consoles undergoing much more radical shift towards becoming PCs with different operating systems.
They sort of move into each other.
Yes. And that is almost entirely a cultural phenomena, that they are forced to do that by a combination of market forces and expectations of convention.
And the interesting thing for me is that all really occurs because of the birth of the Xbox. Because the Xbox, through its entire history, has had that pull. Half the people who enjoy the Xbox want it to be more like a PC, and half the people who enjoy the Xbox want it to be more like a console. And you sort of see this rift of developers and gamers oscillating on that fence. And you sort of see that kind of the pulling on the Xbox, which is why the Xbox is probably the most divisive game system ever, because it invokes strong cultural feelings because it doesn't fit into a neat group.
And as a footnote on Gamers Footnotes, I feel compelled to point out the Wii did something interesting in that it was a console that was sold for a profit, which is very unusual for consoles.
Right.
And it was a console that was bought by a lot of people that didn't traditionally play video games.
The Wii is sort of the pinnacle of this Nintendo idea of a game as a toy.
Yes.
It's just pure entertainment.
What we saw was some very novel ideas, some very interesting choices, and a lot of shovelware. A lot of people who looked at this and said, well, there's only so many ways to move, and we have to take advantage of that, so we're going to make the same game 200 times. And the ultimate problem with that is it doesn't end up informing the culture as much as you'd think it would, because people sort of do it and then they forget about it. It expands the audience to which the label gamer might be applied, but you don't really see long-term Wii gamers all that frequently.
Well, and because it's an accessory. I mean, I think you've seen that the cultural significance of the Wii is Nintendo basically waving the white flag on that they no longer wish to compete with Microsoft and Sony as...
They want to compete on the fringes. Fringes is perhaps insulting. They want to compete in a different market, which if you can't compete in the market you're used to is the correct call. So I don't even mean that as an insult to Nintendo, but
I think Nintendo sees gaming culture differently than Microsoft sees it, which is also different than the way Sony sees it. They sort of just see it as this notion of it's a diversion. But there's a lot of interesting art games on the Wii, which is not to deride. Yes. And Nintendo, it's weird because they view the Wii and the DS is fundamentally different platforms. The DS has a lot of art games on it. It has a lot of genre-bending experiences on the DS, where Nintendo seems to be more comfortable with that.
Well, Nintendo's handheld market is booming. This is not to our rabid Nintendo fans. Nintendo is doing just fine. Reports of their death have been greatly exaggerated, but they did not ever really embrace the change in gamers. And that has made it where they aren't really capable of competing. And for we're talking about not necessarily just money, but culture. Nintendo's cultural tropes are still out there, but I think we've seen them weakened and eroded over time because they're still seen as something of a diversion for children.
Right.
Childhood experience. Even when adults play Zelda games. But even then, it's an experience in nostalgia rather than something that I'm actually looking to inform opinions or hold a mirror up to society or anything like that. There's nothing wrong with that, but they've never really left that box.
Well, and let's sort of take one last note on how business culture influences general culture. Is Nintendo's a toy company historically?
Yes.
They view the Nintendo consoles as toys. Sony is a multimedia company historically. They view consoles as a multimedia experience. Microsoft is a cutthroat business that basically attempts to create arbitrage in the market and be technologically innovative and kill somebody else. I mean, and that's their strategy. I mean, their corporate culture is to find weakness and exploit it. Find markets where they can go be the big bully. And I mean, you see that's how the Xbox works. It's almost all pushed as we're better than the PlayStation. The PlayStation's pushed as we're a broad experience of multiple flavors, some of which
we
are true.
We can do anything you want.
Yeah, some of which are false. And Nintendo's like, look, we're a toy. We're fun. We're excited.
You're not going to be able to do this anywhere else.
Yeah, it's just fun.
And we're going to see those. Next time we're going to cover the modern era and kind of where gaming culture sort of is now and where it may go in the future. And those ideas and business inform the cultures of the players who follow those systems. Nintendo primarily being a family console at
sure.
this point because it's fun. The PlayStation appealing to people who, a lot of it's still the weight of their success with the PlayStation 2 and who really want to follow those kind of diverse experiences that were cultivated on the PlayStation 2. And Xbox is really playing up the fact that your computer already runs off of Windows, so why not just have everything run off of Windows?
The Xbox marketing has not changed. We're a PC that you don't have right. to make any changes to.
And there's still that concept of arbitrage. Stick with us, and you won't have to deal with anything else.
And PC gaming's Steam.
Yes, pretty much.
I mean, that's the biggest player.
It's telling when you buy stuff from other sites and they give you a Steam code. That's when you know that there's a certain amount of market dominance involved in the system. So that's where we are with that. Please give us any comments at gamersfootnotes.com with two S's or at gamersfootnotes@gmail.com with two S's.
And, as a very poor transition, which Stephen will chide me for.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I think is interesting is that we spend a lot of time on the show talking about art and talking about what great characters there are in gaming, and there certainly are. But the ones that are always winning the character battles and always the fan favorites are the least developed characters out there. Mario has almost no characterization, as we've talked about repeatedly. Master Chief has some characterization in the games, a lot of which is added on in the books, which is basically Ender's Games meets Starship Troopers and go. And Gordon Freeman, I think, is just a guy with glasses. So we could all be Gordon Freeman. Steven and I both wear glasses. Spoiler alert. So, I was kind of thinking about what I was going to talk about in my short segment because I didn't have anything super exciting. And I wanted to kind of talk about this for a second on sort of this notion of what makes these characters interesting is that they were early examples of putting you, the gamer, into the game. And they were easy ways for game developers to basically hook you into the emotion of the game, of the harrowing adventure of Mario trying to rescue the princess, or Mario trying to beat Bowser, or Mario overcoming whatever obstacle Mario's overcoming. Master Chief sort of is a highly evolved version of the Doom Marine, and you sort of have this feeling of you know, you are strong, therefore you will win. It's sort of a nice hook of putting you into the you will persevere and overcome, and sort of emotionally hooks you in. Gordon Freeman is, you know, he's almost an everyday man. Like, this could be your life one day if you worked at a secret government facility in the side of a mountain that was doing, you know, molecule collider experiments. That could be you one day. And so that they're the really early hooks that sort of tie gamers into the notion of falling in love with the world. So, I mean, I'm almost willing to submit that it's not the characters we love specifically, especially looking at those three, but it's more of the notion that we love the worlds that they inhabit. We love the way that they emotionally engage us, which is a weird thing to say about Halo, because Halo is often derided by gamers as being the frat boy game of gaming, but Halo has a somewhat compelling story on the fringes. I mean, there's a lot of discussion about religion that's been muddled and mucked up, and there's a lot of notions on, especially in the first Halo, on, you know, this generic science fiction notion of one day what's going to beat us is a parasite. I mean, that's War of the Worlds. One of the very first science fiction stories is, one day a giant parasite will save us, which is how War of the Worlds works. You know, the aliens come down, they can't combat our microbes. You see that with the Flood in Halo. I mean, that's just Halo writ large. And you see the Forerunner's answers to that is this notion that we're going to kill everything to kill the parasite, which is what medicine is. I mean, that's kind of how we kill cancer, is burn it with fire, chemicals.
Radiation.
I mean, it's kind of like this notion. So you sort of see this experience in Halo that it hits at a sort of a visceral human level. Mario Brothers is a living cartoon. I mean, who hasn't, when they were a kid, wanted to be in a Warner Brothers cartoon or Tom and Jerry or whatever? So Mario really taps into this notion of this fantasy where you know nothing bad's going to happen. You're not going to wake up one day and something horrific's going to happen in Mario Brothers. So it's good escapism. Half-Life really has this sort of underlying discussion about will science in the world. And I think it's those things that we like, but we just impute those things onto the characters because as humanity, we need something to point to when we deal with complicated subjects. And I think that's part of the reason why we see those characters win, which to me is further proof of games as art. Because a lot of people say, well, look, the important games have characters that aren't characters. But that's not the point of the characters. The point of the characters is they're a perfect window into exploring concepts that we otherwise may not accept, or the ability to have ideas conveyed to you in a way that makes sense. I mean, Gordon Freeman is stuck in treachery and plots without ever saying anything. But you intrinsically understand what those plots are. You understand what those conspiracies are. You understand why a human would sell out the universe to aliens for a chance at life. I mean, those are very humanistic concepts that we all just point down to Gordon Freeman, even though it has nothing really to do with him. It's more of the world they've created. And so to me, it's almost like when you point at these characters, you're further showing why the rest of the game is art. Because it can overcome having a non-existent character because it's just a window into the world. And that's kind of why I think we should spend less time worrying about the nameless, faceless hero as our protagonist, and more about exploring why these worlds work. What has made this story compelling? Why do I enjoy this experience? In the rest of literature, there actually is the nameless hero. I mean, novels, movies.
Or the very silent hero.
Yeah, I mean, it's always, it's an accepted formula. I don't know why for video games we all of a sudden decide that this is something we should be concerned with. Having a hero with more characterization isn't necessarily always a positive.
No, I tend to agree. A lot of times the protagonist or the character you're watching events through is limited specifically because you want to explore the narrative. Scout in To Kill a Mockingbird is not one of the better characterized characters in that book. That's because she is meant to be our window into interacting with the characters that are better characterized.
Nobody ever says Scout's their favorite character in To Kill a Mockingbird.
So, and it is just one example. That's intentional. That's because the idea, the goal is to encourage exploration of the media, not to give you all the answers up front. And so it's actually, I could argue, better characterized protagonists can actually be dangerous to the overall narrative because they prevent you. It's now a story about that character rather than a story about, you know, about what, about humanity or about whatever greater concept you choose to pick. Oftentimes those can only be explored with a somewhat more limited viewpoint that represented by a character that is not particularly well developed.
And the interesting thing is when this occurs in other media, we don't know how to handle it either. The best example I can think of in recent time, which is a bad example, is Desperate Housewives. The whole story is framed by a narrator who kills herself early on in the show. And then the rest of the show, people who are watching it are like, we want to know more about the narrator. When the creators of the show is like, it's just a framing device. It's just a way, like in a novel, that you're allowed access to some of the character's thoughts. I mean, we spend a lot of time in literary construction making choices of how much of the character's thoughts do we allow the reader to have. Because essentially, you, the reader, are a character in the story. You're just always the silent character into the story, except when you have access to the thoughts. And I don't know why for video games we're shocked when that happens. I think it only has to do with because we're always seeing early on, we're not seeing through the character's eyes. We're seeing the character on the screen so we can manipulate them, in the case of Mario. And then the camera pulls back to see Master Chief and Gordon Freeman because it wants to show you how the scene's evolving in a sort of an artistic way. And I think that's what really troubles us. But that doesn't make it any less just like the novel of you seeing through your own eyes into this world.
And so, yes. That's the nature of good storytelling. And so it's no surprise it's made its way into games as they've tried to tell more complex stories. Really, nowhere is the silent protagonist kind of more pronounced than within the MMO genre. Because there you have millions of heroes that all need to feel like they're the most important person in the universe when it is demonstrably, immediately obvious that they cannot possibly be.
Especially when a level 1 character is next to a level 99 character. Right.
And the most recent MMO to kind of have to deal with this issue is WildStar.
Good
which,
transition.
Yeah, see? That's how it's done. which is... deals with it, as some games have, by basically not making you particularly immediately important. You are a member of your chosen nation, and either the Exiles or the Dominion, and you are simply perhaps an exceptional individual in the sense that you are one of the few that they trust, but there are many others that they trust, and so it sort of explains why there are other players there to begin with. You are a soldier within the relevant army of your faction. Well, you are a person, I guess. Soldier is somewhat more specific. WildStar's launch, which I wanted to talk a little bit about in sort of a cursory fashion, went fairly well in the sense that there were basically two camps, the people who could get into the game, in which case things were pretty good for you, or the people who could not get into the game because your account was incorrectly flagged as a guest. And you were put in, you know, sometimes we have screenshots of 64-hour queues to get into the game.
Nice.
Yeah. That is, of course, problematic. And not today. I actually had that bug. Very frustrating. Finally managed to get it in a non-peak time and then just basically tried to not log back out, which is not good good gaming citizenship. But unfortunately, in these situations, that's kind of what happens.
You gotta be mercenary.
Yeah, a little bit. And I am a Chua, so they are psychotic rodents. It's...
He's
sort
talking
of
about
expected.
Real life.
Anyway, so there was, but other than that, actually, I think a fairly smooth launch. Game itself has sort of an interesting the greatest violence that World of Warcraft did. I love World of Warcraft, by the way. Let me preface this that way. But the greatest violence it's done to the MMO genre is that it is now impossible to have a group of players who do not feel compelled to compare every it's not even about the comparison to WoW, it's the need to talk about how much you hated WoW and that must be why you're playing X. Because necessarily those people are saying, if you liked WoW, you shouldn't be here. They're actually their own worst enemies in terms of marketing. It's like, well, if you liked WoW, you should go be playing that. Clearly it's the superior game, unless you hate it. Like, that's sort of actually... I feel like Carbine, the group behind WildStar, probably does not appreciate those comments. They would probably want you to play WildStar because you like WildStar, not because you don't like World of Warcraft, as that is a much weaker position to be in. That said, I really feel like a lot of the major launch problems were avoided. They did the right thing in using technology to prevent starting areas from feeling overcrowded by effectively sharding them out so that they're only a subset of the server's population. They have resisted the urge to add more servers, which, while that is causing some of their current problems, most people who are playing right now will not be playing in 31 days. Well, actually, because of Head Start, but let's say 34 days. But once
they'll be playing when it's not
right. Free. Once it is not part of the price they paid for the game, they will quit playing. And then servers that are nearly full right now will be dead, and the full servers will be at a reasonable population level. And so what SWTOR did is they opened a bunch of servers. Oh, look how many people we have. We'll open a ton of servers. And then they 6 months later, had to combine a ton of servers because you cannot divide players that way. It does not work. Really, WildStar takes advantage of the fact that most people do have broadband internet. It is not a game that works with high latency because everything is positionally based. That's been interesting. It's a place they've kind of innovated over World of Warcraft. There are other games that have done similar things, so it's not innovation.
But does it work this time?
It works fairly well. I've been doing a certain amount of PvP. It seems to be working okay. I'm not super far in the game. I've had things to do, unfortunately, so I haven't been able to play as much as I'd have liked. But it's going fairly well, and it's intuitive enough to work. Most of the areas are straight lines in front of you or a arc in front of you, and they're very easy to see on the ground, and so it's fairly intuitive, which is the biggest thing to doing something like this, is that people have to understand immediately where it is that they're targeting their attack. And by making it a area rather than just a straight line, like in a first-person shooter where theoretically, you know, you could trace a line from the barrel of your gun to the person, it really solves some of the latency issue, because you don't have to hit them exactly, you just have to get them in the area.
Okay.
And it also makes it much easier to see what's going on when you're dealing with a third-person over-the-shoulder view of an MMO character. So I think that's sort of where the innovation there is not in using area of effect or in using Twitch mechanics in an MMO. It's in doing them in such a way that it mitigates some of the reasons why that is not traditionally how things are done, which would be latency and counterintuitiveness. Overall, I think the game is going well. It's a game that's very heavily focused on exploration and story, and it has an appropriate amount of incentivization for that. So I've been reasonably pleased. It's not going to kill WoW, because that's not a thing.
Do you think this will be the final and we'll retire the WoW killer moniker for MMOs?
Oh, heavens no. People just like saying that. But it's been a nonsensical statement from the beginning, and it will continue to be a nonsensical statement going into the future. There will eventually be a game that happens to be around when WoW goes away. WoW will have been killed by being around for 10 to 20 years at that point.
Won't it just be called WoW 2?
Well, that's very possible. But we'll see what Blizzard is thinking in terms of their next big MMO project.
They're working on one, right?
They've been working on one, but it's always hard to tell with Blizzard what's actually going on. Because if they're to be believed, they've been working on that particular project for years. And
I've always got the feeling that they were that they kind of thought they had to make a WoW killer, so to speak, a sequel. Because they figured somebody else was going to beat them, and then now that they've realized nobody's going to beat them, like, we're just going to compete. We're just going to fragment our own player base, which is bad.
Yes. Well, that's a lot of it. They can't release it until they're ready to get rid of WoW. And they're not ready to get rid of WoW. I think WoW has at least another 4 to 5 years in it. And then we'll just have to reassess from there. But yeah, WildStar going fairly well. Fairly smooth launch, which was sort of the interesting part, was that the launch was not a complete debacle. There were problems. There were absolutely were problems, but Generally fairly manageable. I think most people manage to get into the game and play. We'll see how... Of course, technically WildStar is not launched as of the recording of this podcast. It actually launches on Tuesday. But Head Start is really just launch. I mean, because it's available to everyone who pre-ordered it. So if you own the game right now, you're playing the game right now. So in that sense, it is launch.
So overall, do you recommend it for the 30 days? Do you think people can take a pass on it?
If you like MMOs, I just enjoy MMOs in general, then yes, if you like kind of story. If you're intrigued by the setting, that would be what I'd say. Go to the website, poke around the setting, see if you think that you'd like to explore the setting for 30 days. Otherwise, MMOs are always a tricky proposition because they do involve a subscription, which, you know, so you're going to be paying extra money if you keep playing them. So generally I say either get a free code from a friend, get a guest code to try it out, or if you're really intrigued by the setting, maybe throw the money at it to play it for a month. And then,
do you think it'll ever go free to play?
I'm less sure of that with this particular game. Carbon seems to be, well, and NCSoft has the capability to keep it running without worrying too much about the money sunk in development costs, which is why a lot of games go to free to play, is to try to recoup development costs when that money isn't rolling in fast enough at the outset. Because NCSoft is behind it, I think it'll be a while before it goes free to play. I think that's generally ultimately the fate of almost every MMO. But WildStar is also basically allowing selling of game codes for in-game money through an official channel. So that's the same as Eve with Plex. They have, I think, cred in WildStar. And I think that's actually a move that helps you not go free-to-play. Because people will be buying game time codes for real currency, which encourages people to play, which encourages people to need game time codes, do activities that aren't necessarily what you're going to be doing with free-to-play. So I think they'll be able to avoid it for a while at the very least.
That's good. All right, well, I think that concludes it for this episode. Join us next time, episode 39, where we continue to discuss sort of the modern era of gaming where we are today, sort of the PlayStation through Xbox 360 to the PlayStation 4, Xbox One, sort of where the landscape is, and then probably a little bit about the conglomerate developers and sort of the rise of the indie backlash. So should be very good stuff.
Yes. Join us next time.